It's getting harder and harder for anybody to deny that the climate is not what it used to be. More radical temperature swings, more floods in some places and droughts in others, and relentless dangerous heat, even in places that are typically milder in summer. Of course, noticing climate change and being motivated to do something about it are two different things. And one big reason people have resisted taking action has been concern about what climate mitigation policies might cost. Would they strip the profits from the fossil fuel sector and make energy radically more expensive for regular people? It wasn't an unreasonable thing to worry about, but these days there's evidence the cost-benefit calculus has shifted. It is now more expensive to let the climate continue to deteriorate than to do something about it. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Bob Keefe is executive director of E2, which stands for Environmental Entrepreneurs. It's a national nonpartisan group of business owners, investors, and professionals who leverage economic research and their business perspective to advance policies that are good for both the environment and the economy. He's just out with a book called Climatenomics: Washington, Wall Street, and the Economic Battle to Save Our Planet. Bob, welcome to Think.
Chris, thank you for having me.
So this title, Climatenomics, this just means the economics of climate change. Why have we focused so often on the cost of preventing or adapting to climate change and overlooked the cost of not doing these things?
Well, I think we focused or have not focused enough on the economics of climate change for a long time. Look, we've all thought about climate change as an environmental issue, as a social issue, as a health issue. It is all of those things for sure. But right now, it's also a serious economic issue, and it's hitting us all in the pocketbooks. Last year alone, Chris, we had $150 billion worth of direct damage from climate-related disasters, according to NOAA. Wildfires in the West, hurricanes in the East, so many we ran out of names for them. Drought, flooding in the Midwest, freezes in Texas, and now scorching heat across most of the country and around the globe. It's taking its toll, and we've got to do something about it.
And the cost of not acting gets higher every year, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Last year alone, the cost of climate disasters, according to NOAA, was up 50%. In Texas alone, the state is averaging about $40 billion a year in climate-related disaster costs, cleanup, et cetera, over the past 5 years. And that number has been growing for more than a decade now, at least.
When we are regularly spending that kind of money just to recover from disasters, what's the effect on the broader economy of putting money there rather than elsewhere?
Well, obviously, that's money that we can't put into other parts of our economy, right? And it affects all of us. But, Chris, it's not just the cleanup costs. It's not just the direct costs of climate change that are impacting all of us. That's really just the tip of the iceberg. Climate change is driving up consumer costs right now for everything from chicken to cornflakes, electricity, homeowners insurance, crop insurance, and costs for our military and for our national defense.
How have big oil companies like Exxon, at least historically, responded to the economics of climate change?
Well, they haven't, frankly. For decades, they ignored climate change and quite often tried to create the false idea that climate change wasn't impacting our economy and that they weren't a part of exacerbating those costs of climate change. In the past few years, investors have taken note of that. The book that you mentioned that I came out with earlier this year starts with what happened in May of 2021, when at the annual meetings of Exxon and Chevron, investors took the companies to task for not doing more on climate change. On the very same day, on May 26, 2021, a court in The Hague ruled in favor of environmentalists against Royal Dutch Shell, that Shell was basically breaching its corporate obligations to reduce carbon emissions and hurting the economy of that country while doing it. So investors are taking note of this now, and they're starting to hold oil companies and others to account.
Bob, what kind of pressure can investors put on traditional fossil fuel producers to start to diversify their energy portfolios?
Well, for instance, at Exxon, investors there replaced the board with three new members that had ties to the oil industry, but also recognized that the company was missing out on an incredible opportunity for investors to start investing more into clean energy, and of diversifying from dirty energy that not only continues to cost all of us, but that is simply not as economically attractive as it once was, and simply not as economically attractive as clean energy is these days.
So one example of this is the investment management company BlackRock. What makes BlackRock a standout among similar firms, at least from the perspective of the story you're telling here?
Well, BlackRock is one of the biggest asset managers, if not the biggest asset manager and investment a firm in the world. And each year, its CEO Larry Fink comes out with a letter to corporate CEOs all around the globe. And in the past several years, Larry Fink has pointed out the cost of climate change to our economy and to the companies that run that economy, and noting that business and business leaders have an obligation to do something about it, to move toward more sustainable practices, to move away from carbon emitting fuels, and to do more to address climate change, or not only are their own bottom lines going to be severely impacted, but the entire economy around the world is being impacted by this.
To the extent, Bob, that for a long time there was this disconnect between the cost of climate change and the profitability of the
Right.
petroleum industry, is this because the costs of disasters are absorbed by other sectors of the economy, like the insurance industry?
Well, certainly the insurance industry has taken a huge hit in recent years from, again, the wildfires that we know happen now on a regular basis in the West, from more powerful hurricanes in the East, from drought and flooding. And by the way, those costs are being passed along to all of us. Homeowners insurance rates, for instance, went up almost 40% over a decade's time. Crop insurance that we all pay for has gone up dramatically over the past couple of decades. According to Stanford University, climate change alone has added $27 billion to the cost of crop insurance that we all pay for. And the USDA predicts now that crop insurance prices are going to go up about 40% between now and 2080. And guess who pays for all that? You and I, and every taxpayer in America.
I would say most of us listening are feeling the pinch of rapidly rising food costs at the moment. What do we know
Right.
about how climate change is contributing, among other things, to higher prices at the grocery store?
Well, look, the UN tells us that global food prices have jumped more than 70% since mid-2020, hit their highest level in March of 22. As you mentioned, there's a lot of reasons that's happening, and one of them, and a big reason, is climate change. Look, in the United States, half of our country is in drought right now. In California, the nation's salad bowl, if you will, 90% of the state is in drought. In Kansas, Chris, we just saw thousands of head of cattle literally keel over and die from heat stroke. And in Texas, growers are still trying to figure out how to make up for more than $600 million in losses from the most expensive freeze in our country, Winter Storm Uri. And now they're struggling with extreme heat that's causing crops to wilt and die. And when crops wilt and die, when cattle die, we pay more at the grocery store.
You remind us also that climate change has taken an extraordinary and maybe underrecognized toll on military assets. What sort of damage
Right.
was done to a place like Camp Lejeune, which was hit by Hurricane Florence in 2018?
Well, look, the military has recognized for a long time that climate change is a huge national security issue. In 2014, then Department of Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel announced that climate change is a quote unquote threat multiplier because it exacerbates so many issues facing the military all around the globe. It heightens insecurity in countries that are struggling with drought or trying to recover from other natural disasters. But really, in the past few years, this has also hit home, literally, with our military. So in 2018, back-to-back hurricanes hit the state of North Carolina, which I happen to hail from, and did damage to Camp Lejeune there. It wiped out 70%, or flooded 70% of all housing units, 6,000 housing units on that base, Chris. 100% of non-housing units were damaged there at Camp Lejeune. A few months later, a hurricane hit Tyndall Air Force Base in the panhandle of Florida, again causing billions of dollars worth of damage. Damage, including damage to some of the most expensive airplanes on the planet, and shutting that base down, and it's still recovering. A few months after that, flooding hit Offutt Air Force Base in Nebraska, home of the quote-unquote doomsday planes that are supposed to be the flying White House in case of nuclear or other war. It did so much damage to that base that it's unclear whether those planes could have even taken off if they needed to. But when you added all this damage up, it resulted in almost $10 billion worth of repairs that are still ongoing on those bases that every single taxpayer has to pay for.
I think it's a really interesting point because the national security aspect of this, sometimes it's framed as sort of a vague threat that people in other parts of the world that are facing climate disasters might try to, you know, storm the borders of countries that are doing better. But as you say, this hits close to home and we are not spared from these effects.
That's absolutely right. That's absolutely right. And look, I was talking to somebody from Fort Bragg, North Carolina, one of the energy coordinators for that base recently. And by the way, the Army and other parts of the military are starting to do really good things when it comes to expanding clean energy, clean transportation. But one of the biggest problems that they're facing there, and certainly at Fort Hood in Texas and around the country, is heat. And when heat gets to the levels that they are right now, we can't do the training that we need to do as military, as the military on some of these bases. We can't go to the construction sites we need to as construction workers. And that, again, is another major hit to our economy.
Sure. So even a healthy, you know, 18 or 20-year-old cannot go running for 15 miles in 100-degree heat without, you know, having serious health problems.
That's right. That's right. And by the way, we have to pay to cool those buildings where they are.
So Bob, we got a lot of rather, you know, dispiriting background information out of the way. We should make clear, folks understand this is not a book all about gloom and doom. To the extent that unmitigated climate change can destroy our economy, you argue that action to limit change can save our economy. Give us just a sampling of some of the emerging business opportunities.
All right, we get to talk about the good news.
The good
I'm glad
news.
to hear that, Chris. Thank you. And there is good news here. There is reason for optimism despite the rising costs of climate change on our economy. And first, let's talk about cost. I mean, right now, solar and wind is the cheapest power there is out there, according to Lazard, the big investment bank that tracks this stuff. Wind and solar is cheaper. Utility scale solar, that is cheaper than existing gas. It's cheaper than coal. It's cheaper than nuclear. So as those prices continue to come down, that makes it more affordable, if you will, for utilities, for big businesses that use a lot of electricity. Think big tech companies that have data centers, that sort of thing, and manufacturers to use cheaper, cleaner energy. And by the way, deliver that energy to consumers. Look at transportation. Right now, every single automaker there is shifting to electric vehicles. Why? Because over time, they cost less to operate, because the technology is caught up, and because they know that consumers are sick and tired of paying $5, $6, $7 a gallon for gasoline, and remaining shackled to global oil markets that are controlled by foreign dictators. And then simply the third leg of clean energy, if you will, which is by far the biggest leg, if you will, which is energy efficiency. Energy efficiency products can now save homeowners and businesses with every monthly power bill with simple things like LED lighting, programmable thermostats, high efficiency HVAC systems, and hot water heaters, simple, better windows and doors, Chris. And the whole point is that technology is starting to catch up with the problem. It has caught up with the problem in many cases, you know. The solar panels that we have today are not what Jimmy Carter put on the White House in the 70s, and the Teslas and other electric vehicles that are out there now are not the early electric cars that GM produced. But in order to address the climate crisis and do it quickly enough, we've got to make these things more affordable, more available to more Americans. And that's where policy comes in.
Well, how did tax credits signed into law by Republican presidents help set us up for the important shift in the cost of wind and solar at industrial scale?
Well, it did. Not just signed by Republicans, but initiated by Republicans, including one, George Bush of Texas. The reason that solar and wind prices have come down to where they are is because of the groundbreaking work at the Department of Energy and throughout the Bush administration and beyond that sped up the innovation to bring these prices down.
Is the way to get solar capacity, just as great as it can possibly be built, is that likely to happen with more and more individual Americans putting solar units on top of their house or their small business? Or is this something that really needs to happen, with energy companies sort of setting up these giant farms of windmills and also solar panels?
Chris, I think the answer is yes
To both.
to both. But look around Dallas or look around any part of our country, and what do you see? You see buildings with a lot of rooftops. And in many cases, or most cases, those rooftops can hold solar, but they don't. Imagine if we could get more solar on all of the rooftops that we have all around the country. But it's not just there. Yes, it's on rural lands. One of the good things about clean energy that I've heard from farmers in Iowa and ranchers in Texas is that the financial benefits from leasing space for these things can sometimes not just augment the income that those farms bring in, but in many cases, sometimes save those family farms.
All right, I want to go to the phone. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. Kitty is calling us from Garland, Texas. Hi, Kitty.
Hi. I actually, as I'm sitting here, I'm going, I have three questions.
Well, just pick your favorite one if you would.
Pick my favorite one. Okay. Well, I'm from Garland, and that's right by Dallas. I'll start with the heat. With the heat that we have, is there some kind of energy catching device to take this heat, sort of the same thing as solar, to take the heat and convert it and store it into some kind of energy? And I guess I can take my answer offline, I guess.
Thanks for calling. What do you know about that, Bob?
Well, what I know is that there's thermal heating and cooling systems that do exactly what Kitty is talking about. And they are growing in popularity. I mean, we're talking about this. This is a technology that started with people who put the big black panels on their roof to heat up the water for their swimming pools. We can now use that for heating up, for instance, our hot water in our buildings and our schools and our homes.
How has the Biden administration committed to climate change in what strikes you as a more robust way than any White House in the past?
Well, clearly the Biden administration has done more and said more on climate change than any administration previous. And as I outline in my book, Chris, we have a climate cabinet now that is or a cabinet that is filled with climate leaders like none this country has ever had, starting with John Kerry and Gina McCarthy. The international and national climate czars, if you will. And the Biden administration has certainly pursued legislation as the primary way to get its agenda passed. That legislation, as we know now, has stalled in Congress, unfortunately. But that doesn't mean that the administration isn't already doing a lot on this. And it doesn't mean that they can't do a lot more. The fact is, the government is the biggest buyer of goods in the world. And those goods include energy, those goods include transportation and transportation fuels. So what we know is that the Biden administration wants to shift the entirety of government to clean energy and clean transportation as quickly as possible. That's going to send a huge market signal to the rest of the economy and to clean energy companies, and ultimately help drive down prices for some of these things for consumers and businesses alike. That's one thing that they're doing.
What do you make of that stall in Congress? As you note in the book, some of the greatest resistance to these ideas has come not from the Republicans, but from members of the president's own party.
Well, certainly, Senator Joe Manchin from West Virginia has been the key to getting this legislation passed in Congress. Recently, he said that it's not the right time to do it. He's worried about inflation. And look, we all need to be worried about inflation. But we also need to be worried about those costs of climate change. $150 billion in damage last year, that's a huge amount of money. That's more than the gross state product of about 15 states in this country. Imagine anything else sucking $150 billion out of our economy, Chris. Congress would be working hard to address that. The president would be working hard to address that. We've got to do this.
I don't know if you've sat down one-on-one with Senator Manchin. I mean, what have you learned about making your case to people who say, but the economic effects right in the short term are too great for us to handle at this moment?
Well, again, we need to think about things like inflation, but we need to think about those costs that I mentioned. We also need to think about the benefits that we've been talking about. We can bring cheaper, cleaner energy to more Americans. We can make things like electric vehicles more accessible for more Americans, so it's not just rich folks in California or Dallas or wherever driving them. And we can help consumers and homeowners and renters with every monthly electric bill by expanding energy efficiency programs. But we can also create a lot of jobs and drive economic growth and drive investments by doing this, Chris. My organization, E2, for more than a decade now, has tracked clean energy jobs across the country. What we know is that there are now about 3.2 million people that work in clean energy, including more than 220,000 in Texas alone. And the reason those jobs exist is in part because of policies in the past that have expanded clean energy. With more policies, we can create more of these jobs.
Do those clean energy jobs pay as well as, say, working in oil fields or coal mines, broadly speaking?
So we did a study a couple years ago that looked at Department of Labor data and other sources to try to find out what these jobs pay. And what we know now is that clean energy jobs pay about 25% more than the national average or the national median wage. These jobs pay about $24 an hour on average. By the way, this was in 2019. They pay about $24 on average, $25 on average. That is on par or more than extraction jobs in oil and gas and in coal. When you add in things like pipelines and utilities, et cetera, it's a little less than oil and gas jobs. But in terms of extraction versus solar versus wind versus energy efficiency, et cetera, they're pretty much on par with fossil fuel jobs. And by the way, they're growing, whereas we know that fossil fuel jobs, especially in coal, have been declining.
Are those clean energy jobs mostly opening up, Bob, in very blue states around the country? Where are they located?
Well, one of the things that we did when we studied this, Chris, is look at where these jobs are. And what we know is that these jobs are almost now almost evenly split between Republican congressional districts and Democratic congressional districts. You know, when clean energy, when solar, wind, et cetera, was just getting started, sure, it was mainly in California, with a little bit in New York and other states. But look, for instance, now where these electric vehicle companies are locating. Yes, there's some in Detroit and other parts of the Midwest, but it's Texas, it's Tennessee, it's Kentucky, it's South Carolina, red states, if you will, conservative states. That's where these jobs are going now. And when you look at something like energy efficiency, that's not something that is limited to red states or blue states. Everybody cares about energy efficiency. And when you look at renewable energy, solar and wind, Texas is now the number one wind state and one of the biggest solar states in the country. California is still number one, but for instance, North Carolina is number four, I think, for solar right now. So, unlike fossil fuels, unlike other industries, unlike coal, these jobs don't depend on geology, they don't depend on geography, and they certainly shouldn't depend on politics.
One concern you do have is that the clean energy sector has a diversity problem. What does that look like and why is it happening?
It does. And frankly, it's partly because of where this clean energy employment was traditionally. That's starting to change now that, for instance, we're seeing more clean energy in the Southeast and in the South generally. But we did a study a couple of years ago at E2, Chris, that looked at the demographics behind clean energy. And what we found was that you're right, it has a diversity problem. Women make up about 30% of clean energy jobs across the entire workforce. They make up 50%. Blacks and African Americans make up only about 8% of clean energy jobs, and they make up 12 to 13% of the entire workforce. Hispanic and Latino workers make up, I think, about 13, 14% of clean energy jobs, slightly less than they did in across the workforce generally. So by expanding clean energy, by using policy to do that, the Biden administration and others have the opportunity to make sure that these jobs grow across the country and in the communities that need them the most.
Is the pool of clean energy workers somehow less diverse than the pool of traditional energy workers?
I don't know that that's the case. What I do know is that we need to do a better job of letting communities all across the country know that these jobs exist. Let me give you one example. We have a woman that was affiliated with E2 in Chicago, a Hispanic woman who came from a low-income community outside of Chicago. And she had no idea what solar jobs were. She barely knew what solar was when she went to high school. One day she was taking a vocational class at her high school, and the teacher talked about jobs in electrical engineering and electrical work generally. And part of that discussion mentioned jobs in solar. Well, she found out about that, and she went on to have a great career, get a great job, and have a great career in solar. But she would have never known about that job, Chris, or even that opportunity, if not for one high school teacher who happened to mention it in a class. We need to make sure that young folks that are coming up right now know that these are some of the fastest growing jobs in the country, that they pay better than average, and they're available in every part of the country.
So they don't have to be clustered around urban centers. They can be anywhere.
Absolutely. As a matter of fact, when we looked at our jobs data, there rural America has almost as many clean energy jobs, probably more clean energy jobs than do urban areas.
Bob, how are major companies starting to take action on reducing greenhouse gas emissions and energy use, even in the absence of federal mandates to do so?
Right. Thank you for that. Well, again, it comes down to a matter of economics in some cases. And as mentioned earlier, the cheapest power available right now is solar and wind. As a result, just about every major company in America, every Fortune 500 company in America, led especially by tech industries that use a lot of power, are shifting to solar and wind and renewable energy. More and more companies are switching to electric vehicles as soon as they become available to them, to save money on gasoline. And so the fact that clean energy is cheaper generally is starting to drive things, especially at major companies around the country.
Electric vehicles seems to make perfect sense as, fleet vehicles for companies, especially if they return to a home base and they can charge up overnight or at whatever time. How are we doing with the infrastructure to make it really possible and practical for everyone who has a car to drive an electric vehicle rather than a gas-powered vehicle?
Well, it's getting better, but we certainly still have a long way to go. Under the infrastructure policy that was passed by Congress earlier this year, that's going to invest billions of dollars into vehicle charging across the country. That's going to help a lot. But there's also the incentive for hotels, for gas stations even, to start deploying more electric vehicle charging, not because they can necessarily make a lot of money off of that, but think about when you pull into a truck stop, or think about when you pull into a convenience store on the highway or a restaurant off of the highway to eat lunch. You can plug in your car while you're eating that lunch, and have a fill up for $18, $20 versus $100 worth of gas, while you're waiting.
All right, let's go back to the phones. We have Austin on the line in Fort Worth, Texas. Hi, Austin. Hi, go right ahead, please.
Yeah, on the topic of electric charging stations, as we see those pop up across the country, what is being used to fuel those electric charging stations? Do we have diesel generators hooked up to those? I mean, are we burning fossil fuels to fuel electric cars, I guess is what I'm asking.
Thanks for calling.
Great, great question. And the answer is hopefully not. Look, the way this works is that we charge electric vehicles with renewable energy. And right now, as states across the country deploy more renewable energy, that's going to put more renewables on the grid that will go to those EVs.
What did we learn from COVID lockdowns about how reducing emissions can improve the climate?
Well, what we learned was that when we're not filling our streets with gas-burning vehicles, when we're not turning on the lights in our offices every single day and on office towers all around the country, it reduces carbon emissions. I mean, it's as simple as that, Chris. The thing about COVID was that it forced us to do that, unfortunately. And what we saw was, for instance, wildlife starting to come back. There were reports all over the world of wildlife coming back to places that they haven't been seen in years. You had things like the Venice canals suddenly get so clean that you could actually see through them, or see the bottom of those canals, and the visibility was so much better in bodies of water all around the world, and pollution obviously went down as well. COVID forced us to do those things. We got a taste of what the world would look like with less pollution. And the good news is we can get there. We can get there with technology, with policy, and with the will to do it.
We now have the situation where office occupancy around the country has been at about 50% for a couple of years now, at or below 50%. So we have some people who are working these hybrid schedules, right? They're at home 3 days a week, and maybe they go into an office 2 days a week. This seems to me as if you're now powering up those offices all day long and you're powering homes. Do we need to sort of get a handle on where people are going to be and get real estate occupancy right-sized so that we're not spending a lot of energy to essentially power spaces for people in two places at once?
Well, right. I mean, again, out of bad things can sometimes come good things. And we've all learned how to work from home now, right? And that saves electricity in those big office towers, but it also saves greenhouse gas emissions when we crank up our car or our truck and drive to work. I hope we can figure out better ways to reduce our energy consumption in this country and on this planet, because we've got to do it to reduce those costs that we were talking about earlier, the cost of climate change.
The Treasury Department under Secretary Janet Yellen made what you call a fundamental shift in its duties a little over a year ago. What changed?
Well, the Department of Treasury began to look at ways, as part of President Biden's goal of engaging the whole of government on climate change. The Treasury Department began to look at ways to shift companies toward cleaner energy and protect investors from investing in companies that are going to be damaged by the ongoing shift to cleaner energy. And that's just one more lever that the Biden administration and the executive branch is using and can use, even in the face of legislation being derailed right now.
Do investors need to retrain themselves to look for profits on a longer time horizon than we've gotten used to?
That's a great question, and I don't really know the answer to that. I think that investors, if they care about the long-term, their long-term investments, it's hard to make great long-term investments when your economy is cratering or being hammered by climate disasters. And it's hard to justify investing in the companies that are exacerbating that damage and not in companies that are moving toward a cleaner future that we all know we need to move to.
What is in the Build Back Better Act that you're excited about?
Well, unfortunately, the Build Back Better Act is on the sidelines right now, but it basically included a number of investments and a number of tax credits that would have reduced the cost of solar and wind and other forms and battery storage through tax credits and deployed more of that. It would have extended and expanded tax credits for electric vehicles that would have made those more commonplace and more available to more consumers. And it would have invested heavily into weatherization and other energy efficiency programs that would make things like high efficiency heat pumps and HVAC systems and hot water heaters and simple better insulation and windows and doors for consumers across the country that could save money with every monthly power bill.
It sounds like there's not necessarily a magic bullet when it comes to tax credits to get this all done. Do you have a sense, based on the evidence, of what kinds of tax credits are most effective in encouraging decisions that benefit the climate in the long term?
Well, we know that tax credits work. We know that federal investments work. We know that from the American Recovery Act during the Obama administration in the last major economic downturn, the Great Recession, if you will. And back then, we invested something like $90 billion into clean energy projects and into climate smart projects around the country. What did we get for that, Chris? What we got was about 100,000 clean energy projects all across the country. It jump-started the wind industry in West Texas. It made solar, it brought out new technologies in solar and wind and in advanced batteries. And by the way, it also made a loan to a little company called Tesla, which was fully paid back, that frankly revolutionized the auto industry in America. $90 billion was a lot of money, but when you look at what the returns are on that, according to the Department of Energy and others that were affiliated with that, the returns have been multifold in terms of consumer savings, in terms of private investment follow-ons. We have the opportunity to do more of that right now, and we need to do it, but it's going to take Congress to act.
We have talked a lot about Washington in this conversation, Bob. What role can state governments play in creating a clean energy economy that might one day rival the fossil fuel economy many of us grew up on?
Well, states can do a lot. Just last week, I was at the 20th anniversary of the California Clean Cars Rule, a piece of legislation innocuously named AB 1493. But what that did was allow California to set higher standards for vehicles that are sold in the state of California, the fifth biggest economy in the world, by the way. And it forced car makers to start thinking about hybrids, to start thinking about electric vehicles, to start thinking about cleaner fuels 20 years ago. Since then, that rule has been adopted by, I think, 17 other states. California recently passed a clean trucks rule that's going to clean up diesel trucks and help jumpstart innovation and move innovation ahead for electric heavy-duty trucks and other equipment. And I think seven other states have already said that they're going to follow that, and many others are looking at that. So states have a lot of opportunities to help lead on this. Unfortunately, in the absence of government leadership in Washington until recently, they have been acting and making a big difference.
When you look around the world, is there a country or are there countries that you would consider to be really good examples of how to do this right?
Well, if you look at who's investing in clean energy around the country, you're looking at the countries that are going to be leading the global economy. Recently, Yale and Columbia universities came out with a study that ranked countries on climate metrics. The United States used to be about 15th in the world for climate related policies. That was 6 years ago. Guess what? Now we're number 101.
Wow.
We're falling behind countries like China, throughout Europe, Denmark, the UK. And what does that look like? What it looks like is, think about battery gigafactories, if you will. In the United States, we have about 11 of them in the pipeline between now and 2030. In China, they have 148. If you look at something like offshore wind, we've been making some great steps toward that in the United States. But by 2026, we'll only have about 8 gigawatts of offshore wind. In Europe, they'll have 54 gigawatts. If you look at renewable energy generation and jobs generally, in renewable energy, we have about 630 Americans that work in solar and wind, et cetera. In Europe, there's 1 million. In China, there's 4 million. So we've got a long way to go.
Do you see the needle moving for Americans who maybe a few years ago either thought talk of climate change was nonsense or it was going to cost too much or it was inevitable? What do you see changing in terms of just attitudes?
Well, the needle's moving, and unfortunately it's moving because it's hitting more Americans in the pocketbook. A recent study by the Washington Post showed that something like 4 out of 10 Americans now live in a place that has been hit by a climate disaster in 2021. And look at where this is happening now, Chris. I was in Oregon recently, and Oregon once again is facing 100 degree weather. But I was talking with an E2 member up there who runs a food company, a food distribution company. And a year ago, the temperatures outside of Portland reached up to almost 113 degrees. Well, Portland, like a lot of places around the country, was simply not built for that. They've never had heat that high. He had to shut down factories for several days because he couldn't cool them for his employees. And then once he got his trucks on the road, they had to be diverted because of fires. That's what climate change looks like, and that's the cost of it.
Bob Keefe is Executive Director of Environmental Entrepreneurs, or E2. His book is called Climatenomics: Washington, Wall Street, and the Economic Battle to Save Our Planet. Bob, thanks for spending this time with us.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
We hope you'll subscribe to our podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.